Hello and welcome to Cage Club, Episode 9, Peggy Sue Got Married. This movie came out in 1986. This is the, I believe, second movie from 86 after The Boy in Blue. Cage is back on his grind after taking 85 off. I'm Joey Lewandowski, and with me, as always, is...
And I'm Mike Manzi. Welcome to Cage Club. Two fans, 72 movies, one cage.
Now, today with Peggy Sue Got Married, I feel like it's an important landmark in Cage Club.
Yeah, yeah.
It's really sort of the first cage role with cage and role as in capital letters, as in the type of role that people think of when they think of Nicolas Cage.
Swinging for the fences Cage, like all dressed up and going for it.
I mean, everything about his character is insane. but in like a delightful way. Like, I love this movie. It's basically Back to the Future for girls.
Yeah, it's a time travel movie, and it's female-centric. You know, instead of Marty McFly, we have Peggy Sue.
Right.
And she goes back in time, not with a time machine. We'll talk about her means of travel, but she goes back to high school for, you know, a short amount of, about a week as well, and, you know, has a chance to change things or learn a lesson. We're not quite sure. I have to figure that out as we go along.
So Nicolas Cage plays a character named Charlie Bodell, and there's a couple things to point out right off the bat about him. Number one, the movie takes place in 1960 and 1985, and so this is the ninth movie of Cage Club, but when the movie starts in 1985, it's 25 years essentially into the future. Like, the main sort of normal storyline for the actors at their age is 1960. So we were talking about earlier that Cage was always playing his age, and this movie begins with him as a, you know, 45-year-old man.
Yeah, it was old age makeup and gray hair, and, you know, they gave him wrinkles, and, you know, it was crazy because he looked a little bit like he does now.
He does look a little bit like he does now, but his old man Cage in this movie has a little bit more hair than he has now.
Yeah. Character is quite fortunate to keep that.
So back in 1960, and we can get to his physical appearance, because that's sort of, that's not even the best part about his character, but he sort of, when I was watching this movie, I thought he went back and forth between, like, two different Elvises. Like, we know Nicolas Cage loves Elvis Presley, and at times he sort of looks like Elvis Presley a little bit. He has the pompadour, and we'll talk about, you know, who Cage's character Charlie loves in terms of musical icons. But he sort of looks like Elvis a little bit.
Yeah.
But then at other times, he almost looks like Elvis Costello, too. Like, he's just sort of going back and forth between all these different
Elvises.
Rock star looks, yeah.
Yeah, he's got the black, well, there's, I guess at the time there would be Buddy Holly glasses, more or less,
yeah.
At the time. In his commercial in the beginning, he wears a white jumpsuit with the sort of Elvis tassel that I guess nowadays is more related to Bon Jovi, but Elvis started that, I believe.
Yeah, that's definitely late career Elvis.
Yeah, and also teen Charlie, like teen Nick Cage in this, like, I really, like his shoulders, like every time he kind of talks with his shoulders a little bit, you know, you kind of get like that Elvis, a little Elvis-ness from him.
Elvis swagger?
Yeah, the Elvis swagger.
But the most distinct, or the most distinctive part of Cage's characters, persona, demeanor, whatever. The most distinctive part about Cage's demeanor, or Charlie's demeanor, is his voice. I looked up, and it's almost crazy to put into words, but he modeled his voice after Pokey, the horse from Gumby. It's crazy. And there's no real, I mean, do you see that there's a reason why he did it?
I don't hear the resemblance to Pokey. I watched a lot of Gumby as a kid and got Pokey's voice in my head. But I think what he's going for is that puberty, high nasally voice, like cracking almost phase of adolescence. Do you follow? You know, I think he's sort of trying to play a teenager and do the teenage voice, pitch up his normal voice higher as if it hasn't dropped yet. There's a moment where his character squeaks later on in this movie. So I think that might be what he was going for. I know that the producers and everyone else weren't really too excited about that choice.
So yeah, so the IMDb trivia says Pokey. I'll take your word for it that it's not, you know, spot on for Pokey, but that might be part of the inspiration at least. But what's crazy about his voice is that this film was directed by Francis Ford Coppola, his uncle, and yet Cage's voice almost led him to being fired from this movie because nobody else thought it was a good idea. He sort of had to sell it that what he was doing was beneficial to the movie.
Yeah, I love the idea that his uncle wasn't, you know, this, they weren't playing favorites, right? Like, I mean, at this point, he was just being treated like a serious actor with his own career, and it says right there, like, he didn't get this job because they're related or anything like that. So, yeah, that's pretty interesting.
This movie also has two amazing Nicolas Cage entrances. Nicolas Cage plays this guy, Charlie Bodell, who's married to Peggy Sue. And at the beginning of the movie, they're not divorced, are they? They're just sort of on the rocks?
I believe they're separated. So
okay.
It's, you know, about at the point of filing papers.
He plays this TV infomercial salesman?
He's Crazy Eddie, basically. That's what I got. As a kid growing up, there was this guy called Crazy Eddie who sold stereos and had these commercials very similar to that. And I thought they were modeling Charlie off of Crazy Eddie because, you know, he's got these wacky game show-esque commercials for his stereo shop or his appliance store.
Well, you find out a little bit later in the movie that Cage's father owns a department store or an appliance store, and he doesn't want to work there. He wants to be a musician. He wants to sort of do his own thing, blaze his own path. But it's clear, you know, toward the end of the movie, he accepts, like, his father gives him part of the business, and it's clear that he just sort of follows in his father's footsteps. So he's an appliance store owner, like you said, modeled after Crazy Eddie, with just, like, insane, insane, beautiful, wonderful commercials.
Here, Charlie, my fortune cookies. Good run.
Thanks. What? Next week we'll be selling Sanyo remote control VCRs for $299.
Look, it's Dad.
Oh, no, I'll go broke. You'll give away Mr. VC giant screen television sets for $1,299? How now? You won't be on the show on microwaves, you know, video recorders, ovens.
Mom, you're not looking.
Not just smashing.
Please turn that off.
So I really thought this opening scene was like super economical as far as just filmmaking and screenwriting is concerned.
Yeah.
Because within like 2 minutes, we find out Peggy Sue was married to this Nicolas Cage character. They have a daughter played by Helen Hunt. And we also learn that they're on the rocks and they're separated. Plus, we also find out that is the night of their 25th high school reunion. So like all this important information is just like really fed to you. It feels really naturally fed to you, just like matter-of-factly, and got to give him a lot of credit for that.
Yeah, it's all told to you within probably a minute, maybe 90 seconds,
yeah.
Because within the first couple minutes, they're at the reunion. Peggy Sue is dressed in her prom dress for some reason.
Yeah, she's really freaking out at this point too, right? Like that opening scene, like she's really nervous because she's getting divorced and she's going to a reunion and, you know, she can't tell everybody like how great her life has become, it seems, right? So like,
yeah.
She is freaking out, but like Helen Hunt's like, no, like this is great, like, you know, it's very nostalgic, you look wonderful, and like she goes along with it for her sake.
Yeah, I think that Helen Hunt sort of convinces Peggy Sue that things are going to be okay, but then as soon as they get to the reunion, they walk in and there's pictures of, looks like basically yearbook pictures, like black and white pictures that are blown up for the wall.
Yeah.
All over the place, it seems to be Peggy Sue and Nicolas Cage. She's not only walking to the past of her relationship with all these people, but walking to a past where she was in love with this guy that she married and she's on the rocks with, about to get divorced from.
Right. I could understand, I suppose. It's like there's a knife in her, and seeing all this is just sort of twisting it a little deeper and deeper, you know, emotionally.
But what I thought was kind of funny is that they play Peggy Sue standing in front of these pictures as the emotional, you know, heart-wrenching thing it should be. But then, like, they introduce other characters, like Jim Carrey's character, who's just basically standing in front of his own picture, living it up. There's the other girl, they're taking a picture of her, and she has to, like, make the same, like, screaming face that she's making in the picture.
Catherine Hicks, like, yeah.
Everybody else loves their pictures, so everybody else is sort of, you know, content with their life, but Peggy Sue is just the one that's not too happy with what's going on.
It's pretty cool we get that scene of all the cast characters, like, we're going to see all the characters that we're going to see again as kids, Yep. Right? We get to see them as like adults now and everything, so we'll see how different they're going to act in about 15 minutes. But we get like these nice little just like moments with everybody. You know, Jim Carrey is like doing blow in a room with his ex-girlfriend. And like,
Jim Carrey is another Cage in action of sorts. He's never with Cage in another movie, but he's in Kick-Ass 2, and of course Nicolas Cage is in Kick-Ass 1. So it's not a direct Cage in action, but it's a little bit adjacent.
And Catherine Hicks, who's in this, just like no Cage connection, but I believe she just came off of Star Trek 4 where yep. Another time travel film.
Yeah. But yeah, they're at their 25-year reunion, and Nicolas Cage's character is not supposed to go. Like, I think they made some kind of agreement, him and Peggy Sue. And Peggy Sue, we should say, I guess, we haven't said her name yet, is played by Kathleen Turner. Did we say her name yet?
I don't believe so.
So she's played by Kathleen Turner, and it seems like Peggy Sue and Charlie had some kind of understanding that Nicolas Cage wasn't going to show up to this reunion, because that was just going to make Peggy Sue's appearance more comfortable. You know, when she's not really ready to go to the reunion, Helen Hunt says, it's okay, Dad's not going to be there, you can just have a good time on your own or whatever. But then he shows up.
He enters... And it's very angelic, you know, like the entrance to the gymnasium is sort of high up, you know, you have to like enter and walk down like an indoor fire escape almost. It's very strange, like looking, but he enters and he's backlit and he's wearing white, you know, and he's got the white hair and his shirt's open and he like scans across the dance floor and makes his way down. And I mean, he's like descending from heaven, right? It's hilarious. And they're like, hey, Crazy Charlie. And he's like, hey. Hey guys, and he's like, so this is the reunion.
And like shortly after they get there, they announce the prom king and the prom queen, or the reunion king and the reunion queen. And the reunion king is this nerdy guy who we haven't really seen a whole lot of in the reunion. He's just this billionaire that invented computers of some kind that put one of his classmates out of work, and just this guy was real mad at him.
He, like, stole the guy's formula for computers, like, never paid him for it.
I think I got the sense that he just, whatever the computer was, whatever this guy's other technology was, just, you know, was replaced by a computer.
There's also, didn't someone say something about a book he wrote or something like that? I don't know. I just want to bring that up later because things sort of, we got to talk about later, too, whether or not she actually, you know, makes the trip that she does or not. But I believe someone says something about a book at this point, and then later on, at the end, there's a book from a different person. I was wondering, like, why Richard was successful. I never quite caught that until later.
So you have to wonder, and I mean, there's a lot of things, like you were just saying, it's not clear what happened. If you think about it in terms of time travel, and if she actually did go back in time, then she'd always gone back in time. In which case, Richard was successful because she had gone back in time, as opposed to not going back in time, learning what he did, and then going back and telling him? Like, yeah. There's a lot of... time travel movies are really difficult to think about and sort of explain.
But this one sticks to a pretty strict rule of its time travel. Richard is elected basically king of the reunion,
yep.
And Peggy Sue is elected queen of the reunion. And she goes up to accept, and she just has like this full-blown panic attack. She sees her ex, she sees Charlie in the audience, and everyone clapping, and it's very bizarre, and the lights are flashing, and she just like passes out. And when she wakes up, she's in 1960. So like that is how she time travels. Like she just, her mind, like she wakes up in her, presumably in her younger body. They don't have a younger actress. It's still Kathleen Turner. But she didn't use a machine like a DeLorean or anything.
Sort of like Wizard of Oz-y.
It's Wizard of Oz-esque, you know. I think I mentioned to you it's like Desmond from Lost, you know. It's yeah. Just his consciousness goes back into his younger self.
She knows everything. Peggy Sue of 19... Okay, this is... Okay, this is how we're going to describe.
Here we go.
New Peggy Sue, or Peggy Sue 2.0 in 1960.
Yeah.
Knows everything that Peggy Sue of 1985 knows.
Yeah.
And so she goes back home, and she's essentially this grown woman, an 18-year-old's body, who drinks alcohol much to her father's dismay, who really genuinely cherishes the ability, the fact that she can spend more time with her family,
yeah.
That she can spend more time with her grandparents. It's really sort of a sweet, the things that you realize later in life are important to you, and the things, conversely, that you thought were so important that ultimately aren't important, like when she takes the algebra test, she just sort of has the wisdom to know, these are the things I should be paying attention to, and these are the things I can completely and safely avoid.
Yeah, to me, that's sort of like her like needing to get her parents back together and kiss so she exists. It's like her needing to realize, you know, what is important and the things in life that matter and to cherish the moment, and her relationship with Charlie and the way that it's so interesting when she goes back in time, because her problems with Charlie in the past are like she's dealing with them in the same way she would as an adult, and she comes across like a teenager, you know?
A little bit later in the movie, they have an argument that's basically an argument 25 years in the making, but in Charlie's timeline, it's only been, you know, on the rocks for maybe a couple of weeks.
Yeah, and it also feels like this is the kind of argument that the teenagers would have, right? It would be this half-sided, disjointed, confusing, you know, impassioned expression of just like anything that they were thinking. When she sort of mentions future events and he's like, who's Dolores? What are you talking like? Who are you talking about? What are you talking about? I don't know. I bought it as just, yeah, it's just like a crazy teenager, like confused and not even sure what's going on.
Well, I think that maybe it's her character's reaction to the way that when she sort of first pops back home and she's drinking alcohol and she's trying to, like, she's basically trying to explain herself. She's like, no, like, I'm a grown woman. Like, she thinks it's all a dream, which it very well may be, but she doesn't think that any of this is real, so she's just going to go about and do her thing and not care what people are talking about. But even though she is mentally Peggy Sue of 85, everybody else still treats her like she's Peggy Sue of 1960, which means that the things that she's saying might be construed in a different way and might be responded to as though she's just an 18-year-old saying these things, whereas, you know, if she was a 43-year-old or whatever, they might hold a little bit more weight, her words.
Yeah.
Do you think that this movie was written directly in response to Back to the Future, or do you think it was just sort of coincidental?
Was there time to write it after Back to the Future and make it? It's possible. It's possible the way Hollywood works. There's probably a couple similar, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if there were similar scripts floating around at the time, or they saw Back to the Future and they said, you know, we need to do this with girls.
It happens a lot in Hollywood. Like, you remember, like, a couple years ago when The Prestige came out, The Illusionist came out at the same time. Like, there's never movies about magicians, and all of a sudden in the same summer, there are two movies about magicians out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And that happens every once in a while, that there's just a topic or a theme or an occupation or whatever that nobody's talking about, and then all of a sudden there's like two or three movies. And I wonder if, you know, Back to the Future came out in 85, this came out in 86. I wonder if something happened in like 82, 83, 84 that inspired the writers of both these screenplays to write time travel movies. You know what I mean? Like, I wonder if there was like some big scientific breakthrough or some kind of...
I think it might have just been the Reagan era or the 80s consumerism and looking back. You know, it was the children of the 60s, like Peggy Sue, who now had their own children that they were taking to movies, you know. So perhaps they were trying to make films for adults and children, you know, that they could take their kids to and feel nostalgic about, because, you know, you could take I would assume there would be some parents that could take their kids to this and be like, that's what my high school, because my dad actually graduated high school in 1960. So this would fit his demographic of the time where, you know, he would take one of our brothers to it or something like that and be able to enjoy it on multiple levels.
I like that. And sort of, I guess it sort of also follows the, just trying, even if you're not trying to make a movie that appeals to both people, just like the same way that Gary Marshall made Happy Days or whoever made The Wonder Years, it's just them recapturing basically their youth and telling the story of their youth to a new audience.
Yeah.
But so when Peggy Sue falls and hits her head and she goes back in time, she wakes up and she thinks she's dead, and Nick Cage shows up and basically is just like acting like a zombie or a vampire. Oh, and
it's a blood drive, right? She wakes up and she had passed out at the blood drive as a teenager and wakes up an adult in a teenage body, and Nick Cage comes in and I'm getting future flashes of Vampire's Kiss when he's doing his Dracula
coming
impression.
Up real soon.
Yeah, it's coming up. And we find out Nick Cage is like the leader of his little gang, right? He's like the Brad of this movie.
Yeah, it's not like a gang like Rumblefish. It's just sort of like they're just like a couple bullies. They're like, they're the cool kids, basically.
Yeah, they're the cool kids. His crew. He's the leader of the crew.
Peggy Sue goes home, and I'm not sure, I don't know if I recognized her parents, but her little sister, another Cage connection, once again Domino, but no longer Domino, now Sofia Coppola.
Yep. Noticeable this time.
In her biggest role by far in Cage Club.
Yeah, and looking much more like actual Sofia Coppola, much more grown up than seeing her from that back shot of her. What was she last? She was last in.
She was last in
Cotton Club, right? Club. And she gets shot in the street. And she gets,
yeah.
And we only see the back of her. I believe.
I think you see her in profile and then her back. Like you never see like her straight on.
Yeah. So much more screen time in this movie.
And way more grown up than she was in Rumblefish.
Yeah.
It's sort of. I mean, in terms of screenwriting, if you want to save the cat, it's sort of like there's a little bit of fun and games early on when she goes back in time and she thinks none of this is real, so she just gets drunk, and she says this one line that I just loved. She just says, "I'm going to go to Liverpool and discover the Beatles." It's always the dream, and sort of it's Biff's dream in Back to the Future, that you can go back in time or you have like future knowledge and you want to become profitable, you want to be on the cutting edge of everything. And I mean, obviously she doesn't go to Liverpool, but it's just sort of funny that that would be like her in her drunken little stupor. This is what I'm going to do. I'm going to go back in time and just see the best band of all time.
Yeah, and later she even gives Charlie a song, and it turns out to be She Loves Me. She's like, I wrote you a song. I guarantee it's a hit. She has a lot of opportunity to be a billionaire, you know? Like, she's like, they haven't made pantyhose yet. You know, I know about the moon landing, right? She could, like, sell secrets to Russia for trillions and have it made somewhere in Scandinavia. But nope, she just wants to, like, work out her marriage with this is what kind of, all right, at this point, I started thinking about this. She wants to work out her marriage, but she's, like, with a teenage boy, and she's, like, 40. And I know it's gonna be her husband, and she's in a teenager's body, supposedly, but it just crossed my mind at that point where I was like, she's 40, he's like 18 or 17, and like this scene is happening.
It's a little sort of statutory rapey, but it also, if you think about it, it feels weird, but if you don't think about it, it just sort of feels normal.
Yeah, I went with it for 99% of the movie. There was just like one or two moments where it just kind of crossed my mind, and I was just like, you know, today they wouldn't take it this far. There's like two extreme makeout moments that surprised me.
There's one thing I want to ask you about, and watching the early Cage Club movies, I noticed that his teeth were kind of busted. Like, they were always, like he didn't have great teeth.
They were natural, right?
They were
just, like,
they were natural teeth, yeah. And then for Birdie, he had two teeth removed to go through the pain or, you know, to further sympathize with Vietnam veterans.
Interesting.
But it seems like before this movie, maybe when he got the teeth reimplanted, his teeth are, like, great. Like, it seems like he had dental work done before this movie.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It looks, I agree with you 100%. And they even sort of integrated it into his character, right? Like, at one point, he, like, remarks about what great teeth he has. And I was like, ah, that's probably, like, showing off his new teeth. Like, he probably was like, you know, Uncle Francis, can I just, like, you know, show off my teeth a little more in this movie? I really like him. But he looks great, you know? I think this is,
he does look great.
This is, like, Cage 1.5, I'd say.
But he's not doing his teeth any favors at lunch because they're at a cafeteria, normal school day behavior. His lunch tray is a piece of pie, a stack of cookies, and a hot dog.
And he's chugging milk, though. Like, he chugs so much milk during that sequence.
It's around this time that it's basically her second day back in 1960 that Peggy Sue says at breakfast, you know, I didn't think I was going to stick around, but since I'm here, I might as well enjoy it. And she goes out to sort of actively change her past. Whereas Marty McFly and all these other time travel movies, they're told to not change the past. She's just going around and just, like, messing with things just to see if she can get a better life.
Yeah, she doesn't have a Doc Brown at this point to guide her along the path yet. She sort of runs into younger Richard, right? And Richard, the physics major, sort of she gets him to believe her that she's a time traveler and, like, all this stuff. So,
well, at first he doesn't believe her, and he thinks that she's either, you know, pulling a trick, like, either just, like, joking around with him or setting him up for some ultimate sabotage because she's one of the cool kids and he's this total nerd, and why would she ever talk to him? But eventually, I guess just by being persistent enough or being descriptive enough, the way that she wins him over is by talking about all the things that happen and then telling him when we land on the moon.
And
he's like, that's 6 years ahead of schedule.
Yeah, and she's like, you have a blind grandfather, and you're going to make a machine that reads for blind people. And he's like, what the? I've never told anyone about, like, my grandfather. But, well, at least not her, right? They're not exactly friends. So yeah, right. Between that and the moon landing, he's super convinced.
And then once he finally believes her, he tells her about his, what he calls the Richard Burrito theory, that time is a burrito. And it makes no sense, but it's great.
Well, then we have Richard's burrito.
What's that?
That's my own theory, based on a Mexican food called a burrito. I had it once when my parents took me to Disneyland.
I know what a burrito is.
Well, you see, I think that time is like a burrito, in the sense that one part of itself will fold over, and then it will just touch the other part.
What's inside?
Well, you can fill it with whatever you want. You can fill it with memories, with experiences, trigonometry, anything.
Then you think that time travel is possible for people?
Yes, it is. It is possible. It's absolutely possible for people, for dogs, for elephants, for can-can girls.
Like, it's seriously like the weirdest speech, though. I don't know.
Yeah, because he's like, you know, there's Einstein and these other guys with their relativity theories, and they sound so smart. And then, you know, he's supposed to be the smart guy, and I just didn't expect something so incomprehensible to come out of his mouth, to be honest with you. I thought they would just take something that sounded, you know, a little more plausible.
But then in the next scene, he has an equally stupid idea where they're trying to figure out if she's a ghost, if she's really there. And so what they do is there's a fire truck coming down the road, and he says, oh, stand in the street, and if you're a ghost, the fire truck will just go right through you. But, like, if she's not, like, there's no countermeasure there. Like, it's either going to be, like, catastrophic or, like, to get their answer.
So,
like,
it's
not the best way to do it.
Yeah, you raise an excellent point. This guy isn't a genius, okay? So how did he make his fortune? How did he, you know, become a great inventor and everything? I believe Peggy actually has always gone back and encountered him and told, you know, with his knowledge of future events, became the genius that he becomes.
I mean, she tells him about the word high tech, and maybe that's enough. He loves the high tech phrase.
Oh, but he's like going off a list. He's like, Walkman, you know.
Well, she's explaining all the new inventions, like basically all the things that he has to build. And she's like, everything gets smaller. This gets smaller, that gets smaller, that gets smaller. But for some reason, portable stereos, they just get bigger. And I guess that's a reference to, like, hip-hop culture?
Yeah, I think the boombox.
Yeah, I guess.
It was the 80s.
He's just like, he's like interesting. He's taking all these notes. He's like, interesting, interesting. And then they go to a clothing store, and she asks for pantyhose. I don't know if she wants pantyhose.
Well, she wants to know if they're invented yet.
And they're not.
Yeah, and she's like, that's our first fortune right there.
And then that's when she tells him about high tech, and then she just sort of goes off. Like, she plants all these ideas in his head.
She bestows all that info on it, changes his entire path.
She plants all these ideas in his head and then just basically leaves. She's like, all right, good luck. Like, I don't know how this stuff works, but, like, you can figure it out.
Well, she knows he'll be fine. He'll become a millionaire, and she'll see him at the reunion.
The big conflict of the movie is, both in the present and in the past, is that Kathleen Turner and Nicolas Cage, their relationship is on the rocks, and so she goes back in time because you find out later that the reason they got married when they did, which is basically right out of high school, because she got pregnant by Nicolas Cage on her 18th birthday, or she gave birth when she was 18.
Yeah, she gets pregnant on her 18th birthday.
She figures that if she never gets pregnant, if they break up back in 1960, then her life will be completely different, and she won't be married to him. She won't go through this heartbreak.
But she won't have Helen Hunt either.
And she is very sentimental about her kids, and she keeps talking about her kids. But then what's confusing, and we can get to it later when you sort of have the reveal, is that she has her locket that it turns out that Nicolas Cage gave her, and she says the kids in the locket are her kids. But then at the end of the movie, Nicolas Cage says, no, it's you and me as a baby. I'm not sure if that's like a time travel thing, or if she's misremembering,
okay,
or if it's just as simple as she changed the pictures, or what?
So when he gives it to her, it's in 1960, and it's
right.
And it's pictures of them as babies. But in the beginning and the end of the movie, it's 1985, and it's pictures of their kids.
So she just swapped the pictures out. It's as simple as that.
I believe, you know, within that time, she swapped out the pictures when she had when they had their own kids. They put those pictures in at some point. But they looked very similar. I think the point was they are the same picture, I think, you know, and she says one thing and he's correcting her.
I can buy that. So in spite of the fact that she wants to break up with Nicolas Cage, I guess before she went back in time, they had plans to go on a date to this party. And so Cage shows up and has his little pre-date ritual where he folds down his rearview mirror and talks to this magazine cutout. You looked it up. Who is it?
I believe it's Fabian, pop sensation of the time.
Like a teen idol of the 50s and 60s. And so he just sort of psychs himself up by talking to Fabian. And then goes in the house. Peggy Sue's mom makes him Rice Krispies.
Well, they're for the party.
They're for the party.
The dad is sort of waiting there and wants to have words with him.
Whenever he's on screen while we're doing Cage Club, I just basically can't take my eyes off him. And the way he's eating these Rice Krispie treats is the weirdest thing in the world. Did you notice how he was doing it?
He's doing everything super awkward. I think it's his way of acting like a teenager, you know, because he's a few years removed from being a teen at this time, and he's also trying to become of the period, so he's trying to play like this awkward 60s teenager guy. I think he's taking and making these choices based off of that.
I mean, I'm not saying it to be critical, because I love it, because it's so quirky and charming and specific, but like, he's opening his mouth as wide as he can possibly go to take a bite of this Rice Krispie treat. He's like stuttering, like his body, like going down to eat it. It's just like everything he's doing is to show how uncomfortable he is in his own body.
Yeah, I think you nailed it right there. He does it a few times in the movie. He will get close to Peggy Sue and then just like kind of shake or something and like breathe heavily or say like and then like do something. I don't know. Like, he has a couple moments in the movie where he has like this nervous tick.
As uncomfortable as he is throughout much of the movie, when he's on stage singing and dancing, as he is at this party, he is like the coolest, most confident man in the world. And even though Peggy Sue is, for all intents and purposes, done with him at this point, when he's singing, she just like falls in love with him again. Like, she sees the Charlie that she fell in love with originally. And even though she knows that they're going to have this rocky marriage and they're going to get divorced, she can't help but love him because he's in his element.
Exactly. He is in his element, and he's like super comfortable and like really confident and just like carrying himself really well. And I think she's just like totally forgot that side of him, because throughout the years, he's just been like selling too many appliances. You know, she hasn't even seen him perform since high school. So she probably just, you know, caught up in all of that. All of the, you know, all the emotions that came back there.
I mean, the big decision that she has to make in 1960 is, she sort of has her mind made up from the beginning and it shifts toward the end, but it's whether or not she wants to stay with Charlie or instead go after the stereotypical loner, cool guy who, I think he's the one that at their reunion, she tells her friends, he's the only guy from high school that I wanted to sleep with.
Yeah.
Aside from Charlie.
Yeah, he doesn't show up at the reunion either. No one really knows what even happened to him.
So they're at the party. She's seeing Charlie sing. She's falling back in love with him. And then we get to one of those that you were talking about earlier, really awkward makeout moments.
Suddenly they're just at makeout point together and going at it in the front seat. One thing is definitely leading to another. Peggy Sue is into Charlie again at this point, I think. You know, right now, I mean, the movie, they break up and get back together a lot, it seems, throughout this movie. And this is one of the times where it looks like things are going to go well.
And she says to Charlie, "Charlie, let's make love." And the interaction that follows is maybe, I mean, I feel like I say this every episode, but I also feel like I mean it every episode, is maybe my favorite moment so far in Cage Club.
Let's make love.
What? You mean sex? Intercourse. You want to have intercourse? Last weekend, you said. What time is it? Holy cow. It's late.
A lot of things have happened since last weekend.
But you were the one who said we should wait, and you were right. We should wait till we get married.
Well, I know I must have believed that when I said it, but doesn't Lucky Chucky want to come out?
Huh?
No. Your love machine, your throbbing thrill hammer, your thing.
You mean my wang?
What exactly do you say after that? It was entirely unexpected.
It's so good. Like, he's just not ready. I guess she doesn't think that. Again, like, it's weird. Like, you think about in terms of time travel, if she's always gone back, that means that she's always been there, which means that she would have remembered that it didn't go well.
Not exactly, because it's always the first time she's doing it, right? So she goes back and inhabits her old self. When she leaves that body, she'll wake back up as her teenage self with no memory of what happened. Yeah, she only goes through it once.
She's not transporting her body, just her consciousness. That a la Desmond, like you were saying earlier.
Yeah, so I think that what will enable her to sort of wake up in the future with, like, these new memories or what have, whatever you need to explain it.
And I don't think we should necessarily get too far into the time travel element of it all, because it's not Primer, it's not Time Crimes, it's not Looper. It's not these movies where time travel is, like, the driving force behind the narrative. This is a love story just framed around time travel.
Yeah, it's not even as important as it is in Back to the Future, you know? Like, it's just much more the way they're telling the story, it's used as a device to tell the story.
And so after they have this sort of failed make-out point session, she goes off and she finds this beatnik, and he's alone smoking a cigarette and writing poetry.
What's crazy is what else is happening at the diner at, like, midnight, you know? There's kids dancing on the countertop to the blaring jukebox music.
I mean, it's a different time. 1960 was pretty crazy.
Yeah. I just love how hard they sell the era in this movie, though, because just, you know, from the cars and the clothes to stuff like that, like, it's constantly reminding you.
And so she sits down next to the beatnik guy, and he, just like Richard...
His name's Michael.
Just like Richard, Michael's not really sure why she's doing this. Like, he's sort of thrown off by why she all of a sudden is talking to him, but they leave together on his motorcycle, and there's, like, this little visual gag as they're leaving. Some of their friends drive by, and the guy is driving the car, and his girlfriend is, like, straddled facing him, and they're just making out while he's driving.
Yeah, I think that's Dolores. She's sort of like the easy girl. She's the one, like, making out with everyone at the party and stuff. She sees them and is like, "Ooh, I'm gonna, like, tell everybody that Peggy Sue went off with Michael, the commie beatnik, you know, weirdo loser guy."
They just go to some, like, secluded outpost.
They, like, smoke a joint. I don't exactly remember where she said she found it, but they, like, they get really high. Then they talk about poetry, and then they make out, and I think she actually does it with him, right? I mean, they kind of cut away before, but, like, as it fades away, they're petting. They're doing some heavy petting on the ground. Yeah, so she, like, goes back and commits statutory rape to fulfill one of her childhood fantasies, which, you know, you're not exactly supposed to be thinking about while you're watching this, but...
No, but she effectively at the same time convinces this guy to basically be Kerouac, right? Like to go on the road and just sort of do his writing and become his own man.
Yeah, she's like, take that night together and use it and let it propel you. You know, we can't be together. You know, we were just, that was our time. And he does. He's like totally into it. He's like, yeah, I can dig that. That's when Cage sneaks into her house, right? Like, she goes home from the date with Michael. Nick Cage, like, opens her window and sneaks in, and he's got a pillow. He's going to smother her.
Yeah, but then he can't do it.
He can't go through with it, and she wakes
up. But, like, it's so crazy and out of character for him that he very well could. Like, she doesn't wake up when he walks in, and he's right just about to do it right then.
Yeah, it's shot like a horror film. Like, what is happening? Where did this come from?
And this is really sort of the boiling point. Like, this is where everything, it all comes out at once.
Yeah, they go and argue in the basement so they don't wake anyone up.
This is what I was saying earlier. This is the argument that's 25 years in the making. That it's all the frustrations, and, like, Nicolas Cage doesn't understand everything that she's saying, and there's no reason that he could, but everything that she wanted to say to him, it seems like, is coming out in this speech. And he's like, "How dare you talk to me this way? I'm Charlie Bodell."
"You're going to blow it, Peggy Sue. No one, treats Charlie Bodell like this.
Why do you have to talk about yourself in the third person like you were Napoleon? Why does everything have to be an argument with you?
Look, I've got the hair. I've got the teeth. I've got the eyes. Well, Peggy, look outside that window. I've got the car. I'm the lead singer. I'm the man. Why are you arguing with me?
Yeah, they're like standing up to each other at this point, right? They're like both sort of like they won't cave, and they end up, well, I guess they're never actually, I mean, they're always on the verge of breaking up throughout this movie as teenagers. Yeah. And this is like one of those points again where they leave it and no one is like really happy. What does he say? He's like, he goes like, she's like, you know, I'm trying to save you from a future of disappointment with your singing. And he's like, you know, I just got to give it a shot. And, you know, someone just needs to believe in me. And, you know, I'm going to be just like Fabian. You'll see.
But she doesn't believe in him. And I don't know if she's because, and I really do think, and this is where the time travel thing comes in, because she has this consciousness and she goes to meet up with Michael again. I think that this is like after this huge argument, they separate and it feels like she's once and for all sort of done with Nicolas Cage.
Well, I had a theory at this point.
Okay.
So let's call it maybe there was an original timeline. We'll just call it the original timeline. And Nick Cage did go after high school. You know, he got Peggy Sue pregnant, but then he did try and make it in a music career and failed, and then had to sort of like come crawling back to his dad to get work. And sort of now it's like his second choice, and you know, he's very disappointed. And I think what she's trying to do is save him like all that aggravation and just, you know, quit the singing now and, you know, realize that you could just go into the business and be happy and fulfilling and just like raise a family.
And so then maybe she's successful in that in this alternate timeline.
Yeah.
Because she goes to meet up with Michael again and they're at another diner late at night and he seemingly sort of out of nowhere is like, I'm leaving, I guess, she, like 10 minutes after we graduate, I'm out of here. He's like, come with me, let's move to Utah. And she's like, no, why would I want to do that? Like, that doesn't sound fun at all. While she's, like, shooting down this guy's hopes and dreams, she hears some terrific singing, and she looks up. In the original timeline, this is not a diner that she would have been in.
Right. I don't believe that this scene happened in the original timeline because they didn't have the argument in the basement to sort of advance this state of affairs, right?
And it seems like after this argument, Nicolas Cage basically writes like a love song or like a breakup song or like basically just whatever it is, a song pretty much about the argument he just had with Peggy Sue. And it's a great song and he's doing a great job performing it.
And I'm wondering, I'm like, this is like a really strange coincidence. Like Peggy Sue wasn't expecting him to be singing and he doesn't know Peggy Sue is there with Michael. So it's a really interesting scene. I think it's really well done, you know, in explaining that, you know, and just letting you know who knows, who is aware of who in this scene. I think it does a good job.
It definitely does. But in spite of that terrific performance by Cage, propelled by this heartbreak and his lost love for Peggy Sue, the record producer who's in attendance at the diner doesn't think it's enough. I'm just not going to sign you. And it's heartbreaking for Cage.
He is crushed. He's just dejected. You know, hangs his head.
In the original timeline, this might not have happened. And like you were saying, he might have gone on and experienced this moment several years down the line. But in the alternate timeline, this is sort of the final straw. After the girl he loves tells him to quit singing, sort of out of selfish reasons, but also out of trying to help him be like live a happier life. Or embrace the future that's his. Between that and between this record producer saying that he's not cut out, like he's not going to sign him, he just sort of, it seems like he sort of gives up on singing at this point once and for all.
Yeah, pretty close to it. She like has the moment where he tells her, doesn't he tell her like I had an audition and it didn't go well, and she's like, well, I wrote you this song, maybe this will work, and that's what turns out to be like a Beatles song.
It's She Loves You.
Yeah, and he like changes the yes to oohs.
Peggy Sue, wait a minute. Listen, I cut shop and I did some work on your song. You know it's not half bad for your first try. Of course, I changed all the yes to oohs, but listen to this. She loves you, ooh, ooh, ooh. You love me, ooh, ooh, ooh. Oh, I'm
good. I gotta go.
He's like,
she loves you, ooh, ooh, ooh. he's like, yeah, I did it much better. It's way better this way. And then he sings the song. And it's one of the most iconic songs of all time. He just ruins it.
And it's really weird. Like, that's what I'm saying about how, like, up and down everything. Like, after he, like, sort of blows the, doesn't blow the audition, but he doesn't get picked up by the guy, then she goes to him to walk to school with him, and she's like, oh, you're a good singer. And he's like, ah, I don't know. Like, I don't have it. And she's like, I wrote this song. And it kind of seems like they're not together. And then he's, after school, he's like, hey, Peggy Sue. And he's like, all excited. And he's like, I worked on the song. And she's like, ah, no, get away from me. I'm like, what is happening? Like, that's why I'm like, she, as an adult, she's got like arrested development, you know? Like, she's reliving this high school phase of herself to get out of that state of mind in the future.
Then there's the biggest twist of the movie.
Yeah, when she goes, it's her, like, her 18th, it is, we find out it's her 18th birthday. Okay, so here I just want to bring one thing up quickly, is that she passes out at her high school reunion, but she wakes up sort of a couple weeks before high school graduation. You know what I'm saying? It's not like she traveled back in time like a few days before her 45th birthday or whatever, but she wakes up in the past and it's a few days before her 18th birthday. We're on the night of her 18th birthday when she goes to her grandparents' house to hang with them. She doesn't necessarily travel back in time to the day in history. She didn't leave on like June 5th, 1985 and arrive like June 5th, 1960.
Well, I think that it could sort of be explained, and we talked about this a little bit earlier, you know, two different points in her life when she passed out.
Yeah, okay, that's what I was searching for.
I'm not sure if that's necessarily it or not, but it also, just in terms of the movie and like the script, it just makes sense to sort of plop her in this place where there are these events to be laid out in front of her.
Yeah, and I really like her idea of going to her grandparents' house because it's... like, her grandparents aren't with her anymore in the future, so she goes and spends time with them, and, like, that was just, like, a really sweet idea of hers. Like, she has that moment earlier where the grandma calls, and she can't even talk to her.
It's like, she's so freaked out, and she tells her mom a lie that she, you know, had a dream that her grandmother died, but that dream is just reality. It's just the reality of time, that she's from 25 years in the future when these 75- or 80-year-old grandparents just... there's no reasonable expectation that they're going to be alive. And she's just so caught off guard when the grandma calls. But then you're right. She does just like a genuinely like sweet thing. And just, it's the mentality of an older person not taking for granted the things that kids take for granted and just spending time with her grandparents.
Yeah, and her grandparents are pretty awesome, I got to say, especially her grandfather. And I mean, this guy's into some crazy shit.
The movie sort of takes like a supernatural turn, kind of?
Yes, totally, totally.
It sort of starts slowly, kind of. They're talking about how her grandmother knows when she's going to die.
Yep.
And she won't tell the grandfather. And then all of a sudden it turns out that her grandfather is like the member of this ancient organization that basically shepherds time travelers throughout history.
It's founded by a time traveler. And they go to some like Masonic temple with all kind of like Illuminati like symbols.
They're the most powerful people in the world.
Yeah, I was super convinced that this is how she was going to get back to the future. Like, these guys were legit, you know? I mean, they take themselves super seriously. I mean, even that ridiculous, the handshake, where whatever, what do you call that, where they put their hands to their nose and wave, their secret symbol. Even as ridiculous as that is, I was still like, okay, it's all a cover story for how powerful they really are. They're just doing it not to be taken seriously.
And so they fire up, they begin this ceremony to return her to 1985. They all believe her. Maybe they're all just crazy. I don't know. It really doesn't matter. But they begin a ceremony to send her back to 1985. As they're doing it, there's like a lightning storm outside, and the power's flickering. And then in the middle of the ceremony, she disappears. And they're like, hey, we did it. But then it turns out that Nicolas Cage snuck in and kidnapped her and brought her outside because he wants to be with her.
Yeah, he followed her up to Grandma's house and Grandpa's house. And, you know, I just picture him like listening outside their window as she's like explaining the time travel stuff, and just him going like, what are they talking about? Like, saving it for later, just creeping around the neighborhood until he like comes across the hidden temple where she's being ceremoniously sent back to the future.
Yeah, until he senses his opportunity and goes in and sneaks in, grabs her, brings her to where does he bring her? It's like a greenhouse or something?
Yeah, I think it's the greenhouse sort of off to the side of the main house.
She's freaking out, A, because she thought she was going to go back to her regular life. B, because she just broke up with this guy. Or, I mean, who knows, like we were talking about earlier, whether she's happy with him or upset with him right now. But C, because she wanted to avoid him completely on her 18th birthday so that she wouldn't get pregnant.
Yeah, she's, like, fighting destiny the whole time, where she... That's what I thought, too. It's like, if I could just get far away enough from Charlie and not get pregnant on my 18th birthday, then I'll be fine and Skynet won't attack. But then I was like, you know, that's very strange because she talks about missing her children. And if she doesn't get together with Charlie, she'll never have those kids. So she's in like a catch-22 situation to a degree. Damned if she does, and she's like damned if she doesn't, until she realizes like she should, you know, like she really does love Charlie. He ends up proposing to her.
I think part of her always knows that this is the man that she's meant for. This is the life that she's been meant to live. And it just going back in time and seeing the alternatives, giving Richard the ideas and seeing that like she's not going to marry him, seeing that Michael is not the choice for her, that, like, she doesn't really have a whole ton of options. Charlie just seems like a genuinely good guy that wasn't happy with his life. But he's sort of the right guy for her.
Yeah, I also got the sense that her getting pregnant at 18, she always sort of regarded that as a bit traumatic. You know, she sort of mentions it a couple times as like this turning point. Oh, if I hadn't gotten pregnant when I was 18, this and that, and then I wouldn't have to marry Charlie. But now that moment isn't traumatic anymore. It's, you know, one of her favorite. It'll be like her favorite memory. You know, the night that they first conceive, you know, that blessed their relationship. So I think, you know, maybe that was the whole point of her little journey, was to just sort of deal with her neuroses, deal with, you know, the issues with Charlie, and realize that they've been arguing about the same shit for the past 20 years, you know, and they could resolve that.
And it's through that sort of ultimate resolution that really brings her back to the present. Because after Cage brings her to the greenhouse, he gives her that locket that we were talking about before. And she doesn't understand what's in it. She's sort of confused. She doesn't think it's possible. But it's sort of this realization that her kids are more important than her slight unhappiness, that it's the best thing in her life, that it's a sign that Charlie, at least at the time, really does genuinely care for her. It's like this overwhelming, all these emotions just welling up in her that eventually bring her back and wake her up in 1985.
Yeah, she has like this resolution. And the moment just like draws her back and she wakes up in a hospital.
So then now the 1960 Peggy Sue sort of returns to her original timeline. And I guess now she's on the ground in this greenhouse and overcome with love. And I guess that's when they have sex and she becomes pregnant.
Yeah, that's how I take it. And then she'll go to school Monday morning and show everybody her locket and be like, we're together.
And they get to the hospital. There's this one shot of Helen Hunt walking in, Peggy Sue's in bed, and Nicolas Cage is sitting next to her. It's shot in a way that, like, it's looking at a mirror.
Yeah.
I don't know if you noticed, I don't know if you read this, where the camera was, there was no way to remove it digitally or remove it however from the shot. So there was actually no mirror there, and there was the body doubles or stand-ins recreating the scene in reverse the next room over.
Yeah, the opening shot starts the same way, where it pans back from the television into a mirror, and you see Peggy Sue sort of doing her makeup. Her reflection is her body double, because of the same reason they would have had a reflection of the camera in the mirror.
That's a really great way to bookend the movie.
Yeah, and it's just like amazing filmmaking technique by Coppola. You know, that's just like thinking on such another level. You know, it was just like thinking about, oh, how would a play maybe do something like this, you know, or how could you just you know, thinking outside the box. It's just such a great solution.
And I guess if you wanted to read a little bit more deeply into it, the mirror, like going back in time is sort of like a weird kind of mirror world for Peggy Sue.
Mm-hmm.
Like everything is recognizable, but everything's a little bit off.
Yeah.
And so it's really kind of cool that it starts and ends in this way. You're seeing the world you know and what you think is the world you know, but it's just like a little bit off.
Yeah, it's a really cool way to make that point, you know, with a filmmaking technique, like in the shot itself. Like, that's really cool. Okay, so in the end, when they're in the room, there's flowers from everybody, and then there's a book from Michael dedicated to their night together that supposedly never happened. And I mean, in the beginning of the movie, it was Richard who had the book coming out, and at the end of the movie, it was Michael with the book. Now, I don't know if that was history being changed by any means like that. I believe that, you know, Richard still went on to make his fortune with all that knowledge that he was given, because he really is just like, see you later, like, good luck with all that, like, never gonna see you again. Like, I'm sure it'd be fine. But yeah, I don't know, I just felt like this is sort of like a relic of like the new sort of restored timeline, maybe, you know, this is the way things were always supposed to be in a sense, and like that's just like one symbol of like things have changed. And also at the end of Back to the Future, George McFly's book shows up out of nowhere, and it's like a symbol of something has changed in the past, and this is the proof of that.
So maybe this movie wasn't inspired by Back to the Future, but maybe when after the movie came out, they added in the book at the end as a nice little touch? I don't know.
Maybe, I think you might be right in the first place. Like, the more I'm thinking about it, someone saw Back to the Future and was like, you know, let's do that. Let's make it a little more geared toward girls, you know. We'll change it here and there. But essentially, you know, it's the same structure.
The time between Back to the Future's theatrical release and Peggy Sue's theatrical release is only, like, 15 months. So, I mean, I guess it's possible.
Well, development and filming, it might have taken longer to shoot Back to the Future. This seems like there were a lot less special effects in this movie. Well, I mean, getting all the cars and all the period correct elements could have taken some time, but yeah, I don't know. It's just interesting how similar they are. They're like companion pieces. I never noticed that.
But yeah, that's pretty much Peggy Sue Got Married. Are there any other Cage connections that we missed? Or are there anything else you want to talk about? Joan Allen, who plays Maddie.
Yes.
Will pop up again later in Face Off. We forgot to mention something that is kind of a running theme a little bit through the movie.
Apparently the most popular catchphrase during the time of this movie is "Why I oughta," because Jim Carrey, Nicolas Cage, like the whole gang, like every time at lunch when Peggy Sue and her friends are like, you know, what's going on? They're like, oh, why I oughta, and everybody is just dying of laughter.
What I really like about it is that it makes sense that you're not going to remember all the catchphrases, you might remember a lot of them from when you were a kid, but you might not remember all of them, and like it feels like, at least in the lunchroom, like, Peggy Sue is so confused when she hears this.
Yeah.
She's like, I don't know what this means. She's 25 years older. She's got this whole life's worth of memories. And she might not have liked it when she was 18, or, you know, it didn't stick with her. And so it's this, like, weird kind of cultural whatever that, like, means so much to everybody else, and it's just gone. And I guess it kind of...
You know what it's like? It's like the what's up. It's like the was of the day, right? It's like that's what they're doing, basically. And she just never saw that commercial. She's just like, I just don't get it.
Either she never saw it or it's forgettable, or she just doesn't have the reference point anymore.
Yeah, it was just strange because it's mentioned a lot. Like, it's said a lot. Like, the guys say it, like, Domino says it, or Sophia says it. So I'm only calling her Domino from now on.
She's going to be Domino forever.
She's Domino to me. If I ever saw her on the street, I'm just going to yell Domino. But she says it, and it, like, busts up Nick Cage. Like, he just wants her to keep saying it, like, over and over. So, like, I don't know. Maybe they're just playing it up too much. But, yeah, I like your explanation. Like, that makes more sense to me, that it was just, like, sort of this cultural turn of phrase at the moment, and you know, she just kind of missed out on it. You know, one last shout out to Nick Cage's hair in this, which is closest to his real hair color that we've seen yet.
The nice, like, light blonde?
Yeah, that sort of bleachy, surfy blonde. That is what I understand to be, at the time, most like his original hair color. With the end of Peggy Sue Got Married, that is the last time Cage will work with his uncle and wraps up the Coppola trilogy for him. It's Rumblefish, Cotton Club, and Peggy Sue Got Married.
And I think it's the last time he works with Domino, too. I don't know if Sofia Coppola ever pops up again.
It was cool to see them share a scene together on the couch in this.
And he just, like, we didn't talk about it, but he's just complimenting how beautifully she's playing the piano.
Yeah.
Like, her dad... It almost seems like a little bit of meta with Francis, maybe? She's, like, annoying her dad, and he's like, oh, no, I think your playing sounds beautiful.
Right, yeah.
Next time on Cage Club, we have my favorite Nicolas Cage movie is coming up next, Raising Arizona.
Yeah, I love this movie.
The next week is sort of... I mean, we've had good movies, and like we've talked about, I haven't disliked any of these movies, but this next week that we're doing, the next three movies are really the first really, really powerful weeks of Cage movies. We have Raising Arizona, we have Moonstruck, and we have Vampire's Kiss.
Yeah, and each of these he'll veer deeper and deeper into Cage mode, you know, like he did in here. You know, we see him here with the voice and disguising himself a little more and taking bolder choices. I think it's just going to keep going from here.
And I can't wait. Check out cageclub.me. For all things Cage Club. You can read our reviews. You can find out how to follow us on Twitter. If you're listening to this somewhere, I guess, you can figure out how to follow us on iTunes. Rate and review us on iTunes. And come back next week when we talk about Raising Arizona, Moonstruck, and Vampire's Kiss.
I've been told, though she's wearing a band of gold, Peggy Sue got married not long ago. Peggy Sue got married not long ago.
Bye.
Bye.